Beitza. There happens to be a fascinating, those who learn Masechet Beitza, there's a big shaila, of course, this is our topic, how to pronounce the Masechet. Is it Beitza, is it Beya? And that's a big discussion the Achorim talk about. So the first source everyone points to is Rabbeinu Chananel on the page. Rabbeinu Chananel wasn't known to be a poet of any sort, but he begins his parish here, Aschil Masechet Beitza, Be'ezes Gadol Ha'etza. So he's obviously trying to draw some type of rhyme here, some type of something rhyming with each other. It's a Beitza and Eitza. That was seemingly his indication of how one should pronounce the word. The Gra felt this way very strongly. Others felt pronouncing the word Beitza wouldn't be an appropriate word to be said because the other implications are the words that they would say Be'er. So Yesh V'Yesh, depending which yeshiva you went to, we love all people, so it's fine no matter how you pronounce it. So let's begin with Masechet Beitza. And it's a very challenging masecht in terms of bringing things to halacha l'maisa. In terms of understanding the simple Gemara, that's on the easier end of the spectrum, but the bringing the halacha l'maisa gets quite challenging. So let's try to bring things together as we go through the sugyas. It's hard to go through muksa from the beginning to the end. It's a whole sugya. It could take weeks, months to go through, but we'll pick pieces as we go through the masechta, how it applies. But just as a general background, it's important to understand some of the nature of muksa, the general background. The great sefer that everyone should have, it's a set of three svarim, Orcha Shabbos. I recommend everyone buy this. Rabbi Rubin, who was the mechaber of the sefer, he is the Rav of the shul in Har Nof, where the killings took place a few years ago. Rabbi Twersky and two others were killed there. So that was his shul. So he wrote a beautiful sefer, very clear through much of Hilchos Shabbos. And he just lays out there, you know, has introduction on each topic and then goes through in great detail, very succinct, to the point, wonderful footnotes. So he just lays down exactly what is the reason why muksa was instituted as an isser. Everyone agrees that muksa is only an isser midirabanim. There is a havamin in the Gemara Masechet that thinks that muksa might be a daraisa, but everyone really assumes the maskana it's a dirabanim. So the very simple reason, the Gemara tells us in Masechet Shabbos, he quotes just this summary here, that the reason why they asked muksa is because they thought if people would carry things around inside the house, they would lead to them carrying outside the house where there was no Erev. It was a gzera, lest it lead to a stronger violation of hotsa. Hotsa was the impetus of creating the Isser of muksa. And that's how the simple understanding of the Gemara, that's the Rive's understanding. It's about muksa leading to hotsa. The Rambam has a very lengthy explanation. He says that Chachamim wanted Shabbos to be different than the rest of the week. And people, I guess, were not so active during the week. So they wanted to have some differences. So they felt one way to highlight the difference of Shabbos and Chol was to institute muksa, that certain things a person shouldn't move, certain things a person shouldn't carry. Nothing to do with Hotza at all, just an issue of a Chol versus Shabbos highlighting a very big difference between the two. To which Jeravid says, where did I get this from? So that's a very basic machlokis. Was muksa instituted because of Hotza, or was it instituted to highlight the differences between Shabbos and Chol? It happens to be a fascinating discussion in the Rishonim, which is more chamer? Is muksa more chamer than a classic Isser Midirbanan? Or is Isser Midirbanan more chamer than muksa? Or maybe they're the same level, but there seems to be something different about muksa than a classic Isser Midirbanan. And we'll see these as we go through the Masechta. Now, it's important to note, just I want to make this clear right now, the Isser muksa is to move something, not a problem to touch something. I could go by and touch all the cars I want on Shabbos. There's no problem of touching a car or touching anything muksa, for that matter. The violation of muksa is simply moving an item that's muksa, but touching is completely fine. So now, part of the challenge of muksa is there's so many categories of muksa. So there's kli shel machtel iser, and there are different types. There's kli machmas gufo, machmas chesun kis, machmas mitzvah. There are many categories, and each category has different halachas related to it. That's part of the confusion. I'm just trying to lay down some just basic background for everyone. Also, there's a machlokas, which we'll see later on, probably next week. I don't think we saw this just yet. A machlokas whether muksa even exists at all. There's a machlokas, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon, whether muksa was accepted, halach l'mais or not. Now, Rabbi Shimon says muksa does not exist. Rabbi Yehuda holds that muksa does exist. So what he explains down here, and this is very clear, like this is like the most confusing part, because when you read Masechet Beitza muksa, The Gemara is going to tell us next week, we're going to learn, there's no muksa on Shabbos. Right? The Gemara is going to say, Rabbi Shimon says there's no muksa, Rabbi Yehuda says that there is muksa, and Gemara says there's no stira. Rabbi Yehuda is referring to Yontif, there is muksa, because since Yontif is a very low-level day, we want to compensate. So we say there is muksa on Yontif, and we hold like Rabbi Shimon on Shabbos, there is no muksa. So wait, there's no muksa on Shabbos? Of course there's muksa on Shabbos. How does the Gemara say there's no muksa on Shabbos? So what he goes to, Reuben just explains very clearly, right in the beginning here, he says, no, that's regarding certain things that are usable. When it comes to fruit, let's say fruit. So he says, peiros ha'omdim lemechira, fruit that were set aside to be sold as merchandise. That's where there's machlokas. Rabbi Shimon says those items aren't muksa. Rabbi Yehuda says those items are muksa. But when it comes to things that have no use, such as eitz and avanim, rocks and trees and wood and branches, everybody agrees there's muksa. When Rabbi Shimon says there's no muksa on Shabbos, that's regarding things that have a purpose. That's what we say. But things that have no purpose, everybody agrees, of course, that there is muksa on Shabbos. So this is just a lot of information, just kind of throwing it out there to you. We'll hopefully elaborate and make things clearer as we go through the Masechta. But that's just a general overall background on Hilchos Muksa. So let's begin now the first discussion I want to have here, which is we're learning about a Beitza Shenold V'Yamtif. Who here has a chicken? Anyone have a chicken? Anyone have an egg that's laid? No one has it. So how do we bring this halach l'maisa? So more halach l'maisa is if a guy has eggs in his refrigerator, raw eggs in his refrigerator, how's that going to impact you? You have to get to, I don't know, the dressing that's behind the eggs, and you can only get it by moving the eggs. Is that allowed on Shabbos? Or let's say you're in the freezer, you have a raw meat or a raw fish, and you need to get to something, a frozen challah, to take it out and use it on Shabbos. Well, how do you get around it? A seemingly raw fish, raw meat are going to be muksa on Shabbos as well. I'll add further. We haven't discussed buses. I'm going to discuss buses next week. The toes in the bottom discusses the halachas of buses, which means if muksa is on something that's mutter. Let's say I have a candelabra on my table on Shabbos. I can't move this table because my table is a buses to a davar iser, to my candelabra. So we'll discuss greater details. So my door, my refrigerator door, or more likely my freezer door has frozen meat, frozen fish. Can I open up that door now? Because that door is a buses to the frozen fruit, to the frozen fish. Or many refrigerators have a spot for the eggs on the refrigerator door. So I'm opening up the door now. I've got my dozen eggs, which are raw. Is that a problem of opening up the refrigerator? So that's more halach l'maisa. So that's the Gemara itself doesn't talk about the raw eggs regarding Shabbos, but I want to discuss this because bring it back home a little bit. So let's discuss raw eggs first, then we'll discuss raw meat and the raw fish, and then we'll go to discuss animals because we're talking about a tarnagol, a chicken. So people have animals, have pets, have fish, have dogs, cats, other types of animals. Let's discuss these two categories, raw food and animals on Shabbos. Okay, so regarding the halacha of a raw egg, I'm sure you all saw the Mordechai. Now, the Mordechai does bring an interesting side point. This wasn't our discussion, but about chewing something that gives a person a good breath. And he says, one's allowed to, that's not a problem of refu at all. To take scope, use your scope to clean your mouth out, that's not a problem of refu. That's completely allowed. And on that, in that discussion, he says, you're allowed to also eat raw eggs because it's good for the voice. It's good for the vocal cords. It is true. I don't know if all great singers in Chazanim use it, but certainly it's something that's been accepted for many years, and I imagine it helps. So that's allowed since it has a purpose. It's the raw eggs. I think like athletes also eat raw eggs. I think they find it's the protein's better. I don't know. So there's some purpose of eating raw eggs, and therefore the Mordechai and the Shulchan Aruch, they're after Paskins, that one is allowed to eat raw eggs, which means it's also allowed to be moved on Shabbos as well. Now, certainly Yontif, raw eggs are permitted, because you could cook raw eggs on Yontif. But Shabbos as well, it's Paskin that by the Shulchan Aruch, you're allowed to move raw eggs. That being said, anybody know someone who actually eats raw eggs, forget Shabbos, even during the week? Very unlikely. It's unhealthy. The bacteria concern that's there. No one wants to eat raw eggs. Sunny side up, right? That might be somewhat raw. Part of it's raw, right? You know, sunny side up. So when you cook it, just you crack the egg open, you leave it in the frying pan, letting it just bake or cook as it is. So, like the yellow thing stays, like it becomes congealed. But like you pop it open, like a pimple, if you will, the whole thing like spreads onto the eggs. So that also, like some people eat that. I think nowadays that's pretty much raw. But most people do not eat raw eggs bisman hazeh. So does that change? Does that change what was? Which is a general discussion. How does halacha change over time? And once the Shulchan Aruch decided that eggs are mutter b'muksa, does that mean are things going to change? Now can we change it? Some halachas we say, yeah, it changes depending on the time, depending on the makom. A great example would be Bishul Akum. Bishul Akum, what's considered Bishul Akum? What's considered raw? What's considered served in Shulchan Malachim? The Shach writes, Hakol lefiyazman, lefiyamakum. It depends. You know, what's, you know, raw fish, well, nowadays, raw fish regarding Bishul Akum, let's go back 10 years ago where sushi wasn't as accepted. So in Japan, so raw fish was very much, people would eat raw fish, which means by Bishul Akum, something that's ne'echal chai is not subject to the Isser Bishul Akum. If you could eat it raw, so if it's cooked, it's not a problem. But if you live in an area, a time where they wouldn't eat raw fish, so Bishul Akum would be a problem. So 10 years ago in America, certainly raw fish was a problem of Bishul Akum. Nowadays, it's a question, is that true? I think, I don't know, but some poskim still hold on tight that Bishul Akum still applies to fish because they don't think that sushi is so widely accepted. I'm not poskiming. I would beg to differ. It's at every single wedding, every single bar mitzvah, every single restaurant has sushi, the raw fish they're serving. It would seem to me it's very accepted. And therefore, there shouldn't be a violation of Bishul Akum by raw fish. I'm not poskiming, but this is an example where things change over time. So
Bishul
what about
Akum is cooking by a goy,
cooking
right?
By a goy, exactly.
How do we get to cooking by a goy?
I'm talking in general. I'm talking about ideas of things that could change, halachas that could change depending on time and place. So even though 10 years ago raw fish may have been a problem with Bishul Akum, nowadays it may not. So the question becomes, by muksa, even though the times of the Shulchan Aruch they would eat raw eggs, and it would not be muksa, nowadays nobody eats raw eggs. So maybe it should go back to being muksa, because no one would eat a raw egg. That's just an example of things changing over time.
Right, but how did it get to the cooking by the goy?
That's an example where a halacha changes based on the time.
Oh.
We see such an example where things could change based on time.
It would be cooking for us. Why bring in the idea of the goy?
Yeah, I'm giving an example. There's a violation of Bishul Akum. And there's a problem that changes depending with the food, depending on the time. That Isser could change depending on what generation, what place you live in. So that's just an example. Back to Muksa, this could also be another example where it could change. And even though 400 years ago, raw eggs were not Muksa, well, nowadays, since nobody eats it, it would be a muksa. So that's just, I'm just giving examples of where things can change depending on time and place. So, in fact, so the Orach HaShabbos quotes from Poskim that raw eggs, in fact, should be muksa bizman hazeh, since nobody eats raw eggs nowadays. So he thinks the halacha should change bizman hazeh. So that's a machlokas. In the end of the day, what should a person do? You have the raw eggs that are in the way. So the suggestion, you know, you're trying to get something in the refrigerator, try to get behind it. So first, try to avoid moving the eggs. Let's say you can't. So this is an eitzah, which doesn't work so well with eggs, but you could try. Let's say you take the item, you stick your hand behind the item, and you're going to, when you pull it out, you're going to pull the eggs out. So pull the eggs out, but kind of try to hold your hand to prevent it from coming out. So that's a way of not moving it, you're just preventing it from moving. That's the next eitzah. And if you can't avoid doing that, you have to take the eggs out to get to the dressing that's mine, then there is what to rely on to remove the raw eggs in order to get to what you want. Based on the Shulchan Aruch who paskins, you can move raw eggs. Yes?
So what we're saying is the Pesach nowadays is not clear.
It's not clear, exactly.
So we're kind of trying to be machmir unless there's an eight.
Exactly, right. If you look at Rav Simcha Baram Cohen's book, he writes, I'm pretty sure he writes clearly that raw eggs are mutter. I'm pretty sure he writes it's completely mutter. Orach HaShabbos leans to be machmir, and therefore possible one should avoid it. Now, on that topic of raw foods, let's discuss raw meat and raw fish just for a moment. So raw fish, back in the times of the Gemara, no one would eat raw fish. It wouldn't exist. And the halacha was, according to most poskim, that raw fish should be muksa. But raw fish was eaten by animals, pets, whatever animals eat raw fish, whatever animals you might have that eats raw fish. So there's a question whether something that is roi for a behema, is that going to make it muksa or not muksa? That's another conversation we'll have at a different point. So because of that, there's a machlokas whether raw fish is muksa or not. And therefore they say one should be machmir lechachila, not to move raw fish. But if you have no choice, so then you can rely on those who are lenient. I would think nowadays, again, I didn't discuss it with any poskim, I would think nowadays raw fish should be completely permitted. because everyone eats raw fish. Not everyone, but it's so common to have sushi wherever you go, I would think raw fish should be permitted. I was told at some point that there are different grades of fish that are used for sushi versus the one that you cook at home, but then I found that more recently that that's not the case, actually. Supposedly, the same salmon that you cook in your house, you buy from the store, is the same grade of salmon that they use for sushi, in which case there shouldn't be any distinction. I didn't do enough research, so don't pass me based on what I'm saying. You should be machmir, but I wouldn't be surprised if those there are certain poskim who already think that raw fish is not mux anymore.
Lox, isn't lox raw fish?
Yeah, it is. That would be an example. I think it's raw fish, right?
A long time.
It's smoke. Is it smoke though?
It's a smoke.
A smoke. Okay, so it's smoke. I don't eat lox. Okay, so that's smoke.
Meat.
It was cooked in some within smoke in some smoker.
Oh, it is cooked.
That
not cooked.
Not cooked. No?
No.
Oh, so it was smoked.
Smokehouse.
Smokehouse.
What does that mean?
So it makes it more edible, I guess.
It gives it a
certain
flavor,
temperature,
certain humidity,
certain
heat.
Certain heat.
Ages it. Yeah. Like smoked whitefish.
Okay, but it does something to it,
yeah,
which makes it different than a regular salmon, whereby the salmon should not be muxa since it's edible in its current state. People have salmon for shal shudas, so you eat it.
Yeah, it's frozen, right.
No, because you could. It's an interesting question. You could let it thaw. Let's say you take it out where it can't thaw on Shabbos. So that's an interesting question. If it has no use in the near future, that's an interesting thought. But they don't talk about that, I don't think. They talk about, on that topic of things that are thawing, there's a discussion, could you use a frozen challah for lechem mishnah? So that's a question that they have. And Rav Avadia has a very long tshuva about this, about using, I believe he's make on the end, you can use a frozen challah. Ideally, you should let it thaw, but if not, you have what to rely on.
For the first one or the second one?
No, and for the first one, if you eat it, then that's fine. But we're talking about frozen challah that can't be eaten. If it's edible, so that's there's no question. Only that's inedible. Imagine Rav Avadia prefers a frozen challah to that of a matzah, though, right? Other than on Pesach. The Svardim hold matzah is not really bread. They hold it's mizonos. Okay. So that's when it comes to raw eggs. That's when it comes to raw fish. Raw meat. Raw meat's an interesting discussion where it's actually the opposite from what we said. Meaning raw, we said at the time of Gemara, raw fish was muksa. And now maybe it's not. Raw meat in the times of Gemara, they would actually eat raw meat. So raw meat in the times of Gemara was actually mutter to eat, but nowadays no one eats raw meat, and therefore it should be muksa nowadays. So you have the same machlokas in the poskim, and they some say machmir, some say mekil, by raw meat, and therefore lichatchila, a person should be stringent regarding moving raw meat, but again, if he needs to get to something behind it in the freezer, so then he's allowed to move it if need be. So that's the conversation of raw foods, raw eggs, raw meat, raw fish. Let's move now to animals. Everyone,
what if that raw meat is used for an animal?
So that would be the same question, I guess, whether raw fish, if it's used for an animal, does that make something not muksa or not? And since that's debated, we say lechachila yushvi machmir, even though the animal might eat the raw meat, but b'di'eved, lechachila be machmir, but b'di'eved, if you need to, you can move it as well. So, yeah.
Purpose for raw meat since animals that it can be used?
No, in the times of Gemara, they would actually eat raw meat. They would eat it. So it was considered food for Adam.
So if we're going to say that the sushi changed and we say that the raw meat changed.
Yeah. So since it wasn't, since that, so it's the reverse case of that.
Okay.
But Shulchan Aruch Paskin, that raw meat is not muksa. Mm-hmm. So are we able to undo that? So that's part of the conversation about changing halacha over time. Okay, that's a very that topic in general is very fascinating about how things change over time. There's so many other applications of this. One that comes to mind is men using mirrors. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah says that a man can't use a mirror. It's called Beged Isha. Women look in mirrors, men don't look in mirrors. But the Rama writes, Bizman Hazeh, men do look in mirrors. And he says, because the society you live in, that's not called Beged Isha. Beged Isha is defined by what the community, what the society, how they act. So let's say in Scotland, a man wearing a kilt, a skirt, that's not a violation, I don't think. I'm not sure, but they men wear skirts in Scotland. So is that a violation for a man to wear a skirt in Scotland? I'm not recommending anyone do this, but it might not be a violation because Beged Isha depends on where you live and how one dresses. So since we live in a community, in an area, in a country, in a time where all men look at mirrors, the non-Jews look at mirrors, so then that's not called Beged Isha anymore, and that would be permitted. That's another example of things changing over halacha changing over time.
But the raw meat, if I'm concerned that I'm going to come to cook it, whether or not I would have eaten it raw or cooked, I still might come to cook it, no?
No, it's not a question of coming to cook it. That's not the question. It's not a chashash you might cook it. This is a question of muksa. So if does it have a current purpose or not, that's the question. So is there a purpose, is there a use for it right now or not? What you're really touching on, what is how do you define muksa? Which items are subject to muksa, which I didn't address, has to be a kli or a use, a purpose. A rock, a branch has no purpose. That's not called a kli. A book, food, fork, knives, these are kalim. My phone's a kli also, it's a kli. But my phone's a kli that's used for something aser. A rock isn't a kli. That's nothing. That's what we call a klisha. That's called the muksa machmas gufo. It's just, it's not even kli. It's a kli, muksa because itself has no purpose. Then you have kalim, which are klisha machto leheter, which is a fork, which is a kli, which will hold purposes for a davar mutter. But then you have klisha machto leiser, which is a kli, has a purpose, but the purpose is for something that's usher. So you have certain items that say, I'll just break down the category since you're asking it. There's certain things that the only use is davar iser. My phone has only one purpose, and all the purpose is isur. I'm not talking isurim during the week. I'm talking isurim on Shabbos. So my kli, it's a kli shel machto iser. There's no way to use this for a davar heter in a simple level. A hammer is depends. A hammer on one hand is a kli shel machto iser to hammer in a nail. That's aser, but to open up my nut, that's a davar heter. So the hammer is a middle category where depending how you use it may be permitted or may be prohibited. So those are three basic categories, but there are other ones when it comes to kalim.
But isn't there a category of just stam protection you might come to do an iser?
Not because of muksa per se. There are other concerns of
iser. No.
There might be the category of moving. There's a category of moving a candle, which is a chashash of it might lead to a extinguishing it. It might be that that category does exist, but that's not the general understanding of muksa.
So the food, it doesn't touch in that category. The food, it's only the idea of its has no purpose.
Correct. Now, I should also add, just general speaking of muksa, a person on Shabbos shouldn't move things, even things that are mutter, unless there's a purpose for it. To play around with your fork or knife, that's actually not permitted. The Gemara, the halacha is that a person should not just like play with their fork to play with it. If you're doing that, that's not a, that's actually called muksa. Even though the fork is not muksa, but moving it for no purpose, that is actually an issue of muksa. That's the brought down in Shulchan Aruch as well. Okay, let's discuss now animals. I just got the shaila. I get it often, but it was Achron Shepesach. A person was leaving shul Friday night, and he said his son just, or they got him, his 8-year-old son, a pet bird. So they wanted to know whether they could have the son play with a pet bird on Shabbos. That's the question. I said, this is a Mefurish Tosos that talks about playing with a pet bird. It's not uncommon. Tosos spoke about it, and the Tosos initially had said, you're allowed to play and move with a move a pet bird on Shabbos. It's not muksa. That was Tosos' initial reaction. But then he writes, he goes on to say, he doesn't think that this is correct. He doesn't think that animals are mutter to be moved. He thinks animals are, in fact, going to be muksa. And this, of course, is relevant when it comes to not only birds, when it comes to dogs and cats. There's a violation of muksa when it comes to animals. How does the Tosas know this? What's the source that animals are muksa? So he quotes a Mishnah, Masech HaShabbos, Daf Kuf Chaf Ches Amud Beis, where the Mishnah is talking about kofin es asal lifnei ha'afrochem kedei sheyalu v'yardu. So the chickens don't fly, they move, they crawl, they go up and down ramps. So it's in the cage and it comes out to eat, it goes back into the cage. How do you get it from there? So you're allowed to put a basket there for it to climb up as a step, as a ramp, to get back and forth to its cage. So the Rashi explains, why is this? What's the chiddush here? So there's halacha that are you allowed to use a muksa item for a non-muksa item. So Rashi says, we learn from here, you're allowed to, meaning the basket isn't muksa. Baskets are completely permitted. And animals are muksa. And we learn from the halacha that you're allowed to use a basket in order to benefit a non-muksa item, such as a chicken. So what's clear from this Mishnah is that chickens are muksa. That's how Tosafos knows that one should not move birds. And the Magen Mishnah says, beyond birds, behemos and chayos, all types of birds, wild animals, domesticated animals, cats, dogs, these are all considered muksa as well. You cannot move them.
So Tosos gave the reason why it's okay, but then only because of that Mishnah it blew away the raya.
Right, so what's coming out, what seems to be part of the nekudas machlokas, the nature of the argument is as follows. Do you call an animal a kli? Is it considered a kli? Is that considered a use? Can I, let's say, make up my own use? What do I mean? There is a big discussion in the post game. My phone, I said before, has no purpose, right? I can think of a purpose right here. It's very windy out. Put it down. Don't want my papers to fly away. The door won't stay open. Put my phone or something heavier. Hold open the door. I could create any purpose I want. So is that considered a purpose or not? So one hand, Tosa says, yeah, I can make it any purpose. If I designate this bird to be my pet, that's a purpose. And the other response would be back, no, you can't just make up your own purposes. Birds are not meant to play with. Birds are meant to lay eggs. They're meant to fly. They're meant to do something else. That could be part of the machlokas. How one can one make up their own purpose? That's that seems to be part of the machlokas here. Perhaps. I'm not sure. That's how I understand it. Tosus just quotes two opinions. He initial opinion, he doesn't quote any names, I don't think. He just says initially he thinks it's permitted. I think he quoted someone who said it's permitted. It was Rav Yosef he quoted maybe. He quoted Harav, Rabbeinu Yosef thought it was permitted. But then Tosus himself didn't think this was correct. His proof was from the Mishnah. I'm suggesting the reason is because you just can't make your own purposes up for Kalim just because you want to use it in such a way. That's not common. Now, it's possible over time, pet birds might be something accepted, and therefore maybe that would be considered a fit use, such as dogs, which has certainly been accepted over time. Maybe that would be considered a purpose, and maybe you can make animals into kalim. But Tosos felt that animals are not kalim, and Shulchan Aruch paskins this way as well, that animals are in fact a muksa on Shabbos. There is a Yamsha Shlomo. Yamsha Shlomo, the Maharshal, fascinating, a very important sefer. He's one of the early achronim. And he has a sefer on various masechtas, very halacha l'maisa. He has a very fascinating hakdama, nothing to do with what we're talking about right now, but he's grapples a very short hakdama to kedai to learn, those who want to take a look at it. It's like one paragraph long. He's discussing the famous discussion of Eilu ve'Eilu divrei Elokim chaim, that two opposites could both be considered multiple truths, and how does one explain that saying chayv and saying mutter is both true? That's opposite. Those contradict each other. Aser mutter. So he explains that at Kabbalah Torah, there were multiple tsinorim, multiple pipes and lights beaming out from Har Sinai. And each person was able to tap in to their whatever spoke to them most, whatever spoke to their neshama. It wasn't that Moshe Rabbeinu was given, this is how he passed in the yes or no. He was given, they were given 70 different wavelengths for a person to tap into. And it said in the Pasuk in Yisro, kolos, these were kolos of sounds, of approaches, of opinions, that they're all true. It all came from one source with multiple understandings, and therefore they're all considered true. Take a look there if you want. So what the Yamsha Shlomo says, he actually paskins that animals are mutter to move on Shabbos. How does he know this? So he knows it because there's a din in the Masechah Shabbos that you're allowed to trap your animals. If you have a trained animal, domesticated animal that's in your house, you could trap it because it's already considered trapped. Now, how trapped is trapped? You know, you got a big mansion. You got the west wing, east wing, and now it's running over the house. Now you put it into one room. That might be considered trapped. So defining trapping is hard. Opening, closing the door, confining it to a certain room, to many rooms. But whatever it is, there's a certain way you're allowed to catch your own animal with certain gedarim. Don't, again, I'm not talking about it's running away outside. That's more complicated. But there's certain ways you're allowed to trap your animal. So the Maharshal says, just like you could trap your animal, which is a iser deraisa, tzad, is an avlach deraisa, so too you're allowed to move your animal. Muksa should be permitted as well. To which the Taz says, who says that? The halacha in the Gemara is you can only trap animals. But trapping animal doesn't mean I could move the animal. I could close the door and trap my animal. But I'm not moving my animal, and he doesn't think there's a raya from that Gemara. The Taz concludes, like the Shulchan Aruch, that animals are in fact muksa on Shabbos.
But I thought that that mamish you can't trap, but if the room is big enough where you're going to have to get it a second time, it's not cold trapping.
Yes, I want to go through the dinim of trapping. Depends on the size of the room, so, but that's not for now. No, I'm not talking now. Just, okay. So then comes along the Maarech or Zeruah, one of the Rishonim, and he quotes from the Rush as well, and he says that that he thinks that if you have to categorize animals, remember we said before, there's Kli, Shemachmas, rather Muksa, Machmas Gufo, that's a rock, has no purpose. There's Kli, Shemachtel Eser, Iser, which is a Kli that has Iser purposes. How do you define an animal? Is it a Kli, Or is it not a kli? And he concludes, based on the Rush, that animals are not kalim, which again means that it's going to be muktzah on Shabbos. Are there any heterim to move animals? So we already said before in Tosos that moving an animal is not allowed. Petting an animal, I don't think would be considered moving it. You might be moving the hairs a little bit, but it gets involved in other questions of gozes. How are you scratching the animal? Are you pulling out the hairs? Certain animals, certain dogs shed their hair very easily, others not as easily. Depends on these questions of gozes, tearing out hairs, but petting, soft petting, seemingly should be permitted, not a violation of muksa. But moving the animal, picking up the animal on Shabbos is a problem. Is there any heterim for moving animals on Shabbos? So tzar bali chayim. Let's say the animal's in great pain. Tzar bali chayim is a very serious din. There's many sources in the Gemara that prove tzar bali chayim. The Rashi Weiss has a discussion in one of the Parshios. I think he brings like 15 different sources for tzar bali chayim. So let's say the animal's in great pain and it needs you to hold it or bring it somewhere, whatever the case might be. So there's machlokas. Some say that you should not violate muksa, even for tzar bali chayim, while others agree, that argue and say you can and you should move it for tzar bali chayim. I don't remember how we passed it, but I do know it's a machlokas. I didn't look it up, I apologize. But there's a machlokas about tzar bali chayim. I do want to point out, once we talk about animals, just for a second, when a person does own an animal, there are many halachas one has to be aware of as side points, just to be cognizant of. Number one is, I remember Sobolovsky once speaking about the Isser Bas B'Chalav. Isser Bas B'Chalav, we know that there are three Isser when it comes to Bas B'Chalav. It says, Lo Sevashel G'diba Chalev Imo, three times in the Torah, you can't cook meat and milk, you can't eat meat and milk, and you can't get hana from meat and milk. One way of getting hana is by giving it to your animals. Giving your animals meat and milk would be a violation of hana. I have an obligation to feed my animal. It's a chiv to feed my animal. By me giving it food, that's hana, because it's taking care of a debt that I have. So let's say I buy cat food, dog food, that has meat and milk mixed together. That could be a violation of Isser Hana on Basa B'Chalav and Isser Deraisa. One is not allowed to do that. So Rabbi Solovsky, when he gave this shir many years ago on Basa B'Chalav, he said when he used to take his kids to a pet store, so while his kids would look at the, the gerbils, the fish, he would busy study the different ingredients in the cat food, dog food. So when people would call him up which food to give, he would memorize which ones is chicken, because chicken and milk, even though you can't eat it, you can get hana from chicken and milk. But meat and milk, you can't get hana from. So he'd memorize which cat foods, which dog foods had chicken and not meat, that would be permitted to feed the animals.
There be a chazaka that the meat is treifa anyways, and then there's, or is there...
No, only in the veil, I'm not sure if that's the case. It could be, I don't know what kind of meat they use. I would imagine they'd use more cow meat more so than using pig meat, but I'm not sure.
So even if it's not kosher slaughtered, if it's from a kosher animal?
Yeah, it would be a nevela, a behema tahora, of a cow meat, even though it might be an nevela, there's machlokas. The Rambam has a famous discussion. The Rambam, we paskin that bas b'chalav applies even to a nevela, as long as it's a kosher animal. A non-kosher animal wouldn't be a problem. You are correct. Okay, so then another just halacha to keep in mind when owning pets is that you have to. The Gemara says in two places in Maseches Brachos, Maseches Gittin, you have to feed your animals before feeding yourself, before eating on your own. There's a halacha in the Torah based on this. So the Gemara actually says, we can't interrupt between brachas and eating. I say bracha motzi, I can't interrupt until I eat. But I wash, I shouldn't interrupt until I eat something. But let's say there's a need. I need the salt, I need the knife, I need something. Then you're allowed to be mafsik. The Gemara says that one example where you can be mafsik is if you forgot to feed your animal, you can be mafsik in order to feed your animal before you eat. It's a real din to do so. Someone asked me in the chat just the other day, he wanted to know I think he was watching someone else's pet, and the pet had set times to feed. So let's say it was, a 6 o'clock dinner for the animal, and you're sitting down to eat at 5 o'clock. Is there an obligation to feed the animal before you eat, even though it's not the proper time for the animal eating? And the answer would be no, you would not have to feed the animal in that case. Meaning, if that's what you're eating all day long, you have 8 meals a day, and the animal only eats 3 meals. So to have to feed the animal 8 times a day would make the animal fat. The animals don't get fat. They don't eat if they don't need to really eat, really. They know how to control themselves much
dogs,
more than humans. They don't know, really? They eat whatever?
Dogs would just keep eating.
Oh, yeah? Interesting. Okay. So I guess dogs are different. So then, but a person has no obligation.
Sick. That's why you shouldn't do it.
So they say there's no obligation to feed an animal if it's going to make the animal unhealthy, if it's not the proper time for eating. But if it's time for the eating and you're sitting down to have a meal, you would have to feed the animal beforehand. Okay.
Could you just clarify the petting thing? The moving is more of a problem than the petting? Is that where we hold?
No, there's two violations. There's moving is a problem. Moving an animal is a muksa, and then petting could be a problem of a gozes, exactly.
But you said it's probably not a problem, the gozes.
Depending on the animal, depending how the how it sheds, yeah, depending how sensitive it is,
also,
yeah.
So it depends on the animal, whether you pet it or not?
Yeah.
But, that no, we, but everybody else don't move it.
Maybe we'll save that for another discussion about the, all the different edom of gozes. I don't remember if it comes up here, but maybe I'll do a share on that. Okay. Now, there's a fascinating discussion about moving fish tanks on Shabbos. If you have a small fish tank or a little fish bowl of a little... We had... My wife, I think, was one of my kids' carnivals, and she won one of those betta fishes, I think it was called. Mm-hmm. Just like, you know... So we had a betta fish for a couple of years. They don't last for very long, so we had a betta fish on our counter for until it died. So are you allowed to move that betta fish on Shabbos or not? So that's an interesting discussion. And the Rav Moshe, as you saw inside, he writes in Or Chaim Chelek Dalet Simen Tezayim that he says a kli im dogim ketanim shenasel noy. You have it. Our betta fish wasn't so pretty. It was, but it just wasn't like in a pretty tank. So it wasn't really for noy. It was really just to take care of an animal. But if you have like a nice aquarium with all the fancy rocks and the fancy green plants and stuff, so it's there to decorate the house. Rav Moshe writes, he thinks it's usher to move it. Because since Bali Chaim, since animals are muksa on Shabbos, so therefore he says it's muksa to move the aquarium as well. And that's how Rav Moshe understands. Now Rav Shlomo Zalman thought differently. Rav Shlomo Zalman writes, and this is Perek Chav Zayin, Shmir Shabbos, Ha'ara Tzadi Zayin.
Rav Moshe's opinion, did it matter whether it was decorating the house or whether it was simple?
He thought across the board, he says us, exactly. So what Rav Shlomo Zalman writes here, quoted in the footnote, he says it's mutter letaltes aquarium, not really an aquarium that we call it, but you know, obviously he's referring to a fish tank. It's mutter to move a fish tank because he thinks it's actually considered a kli shimlach to leheter. It's like a picture. If I have a picture frame on my desk, I want to move it over. That's permitted. That's annoyed. That's kli. So here as well, since the fish tank is there to decorate my house, he thought it'd be permitted as well. But he does raise a tzarch in because isn't the fish tank a basis? Isn't a basis of the fish. The fish is a davar iser. And now it's in a fish tank, and the fish tank should be a basis. And the water as well, he writes elsewhere, he thinks the water is also, no one would drink that water. That water also becomes a davar iser. So you have water that's aser, you have fish that's aser, you have that's add rocks in which are aser, all in a fish tank, so that should be a basis for everything. So he quotes Rav Shlomo Zalman that says, even though you're right, even though it's all a basis, since the whole thing is considered all lanoi, he thinks this is considered not muksa. Even the fish isn't considered muksa. This would be an example, according to Shlomo Zalman, where the fish, an animal, would not be muksa since it's there as part of the fish tank. And therefore, he concluded, or Shlomo Zalman felt, that moving a fish tank or a fish bowl should be permitted. I would perhaps distinguish whether or not you have the fish bowl as a fishbowl to have a pet, or a fishbowl to have to decorate the house. Again, my fishbowl was a regular, just a glass, or maybe a plastic fishbowl with water, and just had a little fish flying, swimming around with no decorations, no nothing. It wasn't just taking up space on the countertop for a couple of years. I don't know if mine was considered a lanoi, and maybe mine shouldn't have been moved. I don't remember if we moved it or not on Shabbos, but that would be the halach, I would think.
Why does the decorating allow it? It's still not muksa.
Because it's considered a kli at that point. Once it's considered a kli, so then you're allowed to move kalim on Shabbos. Let's finish up. We're running out of time now. The last point here is, what about this last Rav Moshe, fascinating tshuva Rav Moshe, about seeing eye dogs on Shabbos. Is that permitted? Are you allowed to move seeing eye dogs on Shabbos? Rav Moshe has a fascinating tshuva. I mentioned to maybe Yishai the other day that when Rav Shechter would learn Rav Moshe Tshuva, so he would first look at the question, and he wouldn't want to look at the answer yet, and he'd try to figure out the answer on his own. And he says, every single time Rav Moshe brings some type of raya that he would never even think of. And this is a classic example. The last raya Rav Moshe brings here is a classic example of Rav Moshe finding just a random gemara, nothing to do with this topic, and trying to bring it as a raya for the question at hand. When I was in Rav Shechter's Kol in YU, So that was like the style of a bechina. It's like you'd study really well for 10 blad gemara, you know it really well, and you could fail the bechina. Because he would always try to ask questions based on a Rashi, which might quote a different gemara, nothing to do with the gemara at hand, but it'd be so important for some sugya elsewhere. So then that's why this Rashi was so important. Now, unless you understood the sugya elsewhere, would you appreciate this? That one example that comes to mind is, we were learning Maseches and Hedge, and I forget which parak it is, but at the end of the Maseches, there's a little gata. And Rebbe Lazar, who was placed he was placed in Nidui. He was excommunicated. That whole machlokas between him and Rabbi Shua. So he was the Talmidim came in to visit him, and he had taken off his tefillin. It was a gata. Everyone just we were learning in kol. We were focusing on the halacha, on the lumdus. No one was paying attention to the gata. So he asked the question: where do we see from here that where is there raya that a Nidui is allowed to wear tefillin? No one like this, like kind of just glossed over it. So there's a toast. Maseches Moed Katan. We learned this a little while ago together. The Gemara Moed Katan wants to know: can a Nidui wear tefillin or not? And the Gemara leaves as a tzarachin. I'm a take or tzarachin. Whatever the Gemara says, it says no answer. Kasha. Tosa says we have a raya from Maseches Sanhedrin. Tosa and Moed Katan. We weren't learning Moed Katan at the time. Tosa and Moed Katan says you look at the Gemara Sanhedrin. Rebbe Elazar was wearing tefillin. There's a raya that a Nidui does wear tefillin. So we didn't pay attention to that. But if you are sensitive to all halachas and shas, so then every gemara becomes like relevant. So Moshe says, how do I know that this is not talking about Shabbos? How do you know that a suma, a blind person, could bring a dog into shul on Shabbos? So the last raya he brings one raya from the Yishalmi, which is a very nice raya. I'm not saying it's not. But I'm skipping through the whole piece now. And he quotes a gemara in Brachos that Abaye raised a sheep and he trained the sheep to follow him wherever he went. That's what the gemara says. He says, wait a second, Abaye, he says, Kemat kol yom bebeis medrash. Abaye was learning all day long. So if the Gemara says he traveled with him wherever he went, that means it was coming with him inside the shul and inside the beis medrash. And therefore he says, this might be a raya that he allowed to bring an animal into the shul. And he paskins that if there's a tzarech and the suma who needs the dog to help him travel. And we don't want the suma to miss laning and miss minin and miss all these days that we all want to be part of the keel as much as possible. So certainly that's called a shas hagda and shas hadchak. And therefore he permitted one to bring a suma to bring a dog into the shul if need be. Based on this, Rav Shlomo Zalman has a discussion, what about on Shabbos? How far would Rav Moshe go? So in Shmir Shabbos, Perek Yud Ches, Ha'ara Samich Beis. Second here. He says it requires Sheilas Chacham. He writes to Shmir Shabbos, you have to ask a Shaila whether you could assume a. He's allowed to move a dog, bring a dog with him on Shabbos as well. Rav Shlomo Zalman said that even though we paskin by a bird, a child can't play with a bird because that's not really considered a kli. He thinks a seeing eye dog is considered a kli, and he paskin it's mutter for a suma to utilize a dog on Shabbos because that's really considered a purpose as opposed to a child just petting the bird. Okay, we'll stop here. Next week we'll continue.